Matt Powers from thepermaculturestudent.com. Thank you for joining me again. We wanted to talk today about, you know, like right now we're seeing the worst corn planting season. Actually, I'd love to get your thoughts on that at some point. Seeing articles today, I'll pull up real quick. I've got some slides ready that you can ask me, including the entirety of your book, which you're now giving away. The Permaculture Student 2 PDF is available for free on your website. People should absolutely take advantage of that and go get it now. But you know, some of these headlines, farmers are stockpiling corn in response to the tough seasons, which is going to make food prices go up. So basically right now, we have tons of people who are becoming highly incentivized to grow their own food, which is fantastic. Whatever the reason is that people want to get into this, it's time. It's the time now. And so you and I will save these slides for later, wanted to have a conversation today about how do people start doing that? And specifically, how do we start building soil and treating soil well to encourage the life in the soil, which will allow us, which will afford us beautiful, bountiful, abundant gardens.
Absolutely. So it's really, really simple because most of us have made it into this complex expertise level, professionals only. I went to university to do this kind of stuff when it's really our human right. It's what every human was born to do, partner with nature, work with the planet that we, you know, have evolved, have, you know, we came to be on this planet and we are meant for this planet. This planet's meant for us and we're designed for it. We're adapted for it. So this is not something that's outside anyone's ability. It's something that people can do if they're really old, really young, if they are incredibly, you know, physically able or not, or have challenges, and maybe even great challenges. There are ways that we all can start working on food. And the most important thing, I think that after doing this and working on it and teaching it for so long, I think the number one thing that to understand is that every animal, and humans included, has its manure go back into the soil. And it's that relationship of eating the food and then processing it in our gut and our gut having beneficial microbiology so that that manure is valuable to the next step in the cycle. And I know people are like, that's gross, Matt. That, I can't even believe you would say that. And like, yeah, in the 80s, that's exactly right. But we know enough now medically, we know enough now scientifically, that, and historically, that this is the way it's done. This is the actual systems of nature. And we've created breakdowns in that and dangers by how we're doing it, what we're eating, how we're handling our waste, and then how we're growing our food. And so it should be a loop. It should be this solid circular loop where we're just, you know, having that human manure go back into the soil. And so the nutrients that come from the food that pass through our bodies, that create our bodies, the excess, the processed nutrients go back into the soil and our urine would go back and feeding into that soil as well. And so all those nutrients minus some that we use, you know what I mean? And embody and hold for a longer period of time, it's going right back into the soil. The situation currently is not this. So I'm just going to quickly go over the situation currently so you understand why that's so important. The soil currently is extracted from. It's just pulled. They just pull the equity out of it. And so they're pulling the nutrients and the minerals in the form of the food. And in California, it's also their water. So they're exporting their water in the form of food and their minerals and the nutrients from the soils, and their soils are shrinking and their water tables are lowering so much so that the ground is actually going down. Like the elevation is dropping in the actual landscape. It's crazy. So we have this extractive economy that's not regenerating itself. So at some point it collapses. And this is what happened with the Dust Bowl historically. this is what happened, which drove Americans west, which is what caused George Washington, our first American president, to believe that America would fall because of soil loss. So it's the soil and having all the inputs that we can flow back into it that is our bodies, that is our future children, that is our health. It's the soil, and it's the microbiology in the soil that is cousin, that is partner, that is twin to the biology in our bodies. And so it's this tandem system, this engine that all animals are really participating in. And so what we have done in chemical agriculture and conventional agriculture and toxic agriculture is we use salts. And so we've salted the earth. And if you remember history class, the Romans did this. And that's what they did to their enemies so they couldn't grow food. They used dolomite. Think about that. Many of us have used dolomite. Obviously, they're using it at higher concentrations, perhaps, but it's still the same thing. And the whole idea is that they're doing solid water-soluble, watering it in fertilizers, and that's actually cutting the organic matter. Synthetic nitrogen cuts the organic matter and makes it water soluble. So it's uptaken by the plant, causes this huge bloom of growth, but then there's nothing in the ground and you only get that for a few seasons. So we're in this situation where we're doing everything we possibly can. We're breaking down substances and making substances that are not designed to go into our agricultural systems in order to make this broken system work. And meanwhile, the equity that we could be getting from a good diet and good humanure is being lost because we're putting it all together with garbage and chemicals and drugs and toxins. And we're putting it all into this toxic soup. And then half the time, every time it rains, like in New York City, it overflows into the Long Island Sound. And then children like I was in the 80s, couldn't swim in the Sound when the warning came. And then I would always think about, well, what about the time before the warning came, or the time where it's like safe in your part, but it's not safe in mine. You know what I mean? And so we're just in a situation where kind of the veil has been lifted. We see behind the curtain, the man is there, and it's like, are you kidding me? This is what our food system is? This is how fragile our entire economy is? And it becomes ludicrous. And then when you look at it, as you do, through these longer scales, it becomes hysterically irresponsible. Because you're like, wait, you guys have no kind of contingency plan for climate extremes or greater cycles that we know come every 50 years, like the 50-year floods. I was talking to the head of, community. His festival is the Building Resilient Communities. And he's in Portland. I can't remember his name. Mark, I want to say is his name. He was telling me about how he was hired by the Rockefellers because they got freaked out by all this, all the instability that they're seeing around the cities and lack of resilience because it's all their infrastructure that they paid for. And so he's going in there and he's like, you guys realize that the dikes outside of San Francisco are not designed to handle like a 50-year storm. So when the 50-year storm comes, it will destroy the microbiology that we're using now, and it's definitely like a GMO that they're using, but they're using a specific microbe that they've created that will digest all of San Francisco's waste in one day. So we talk about Bokashi, we talk about EM, we talk about all this stuff. These people know what they're doing. Like they took all those things and then like modified it to a mutant level, but it's fragile, like all GMOs, right? Super, super fragile. This is a laboratory being. This is not created by nature where it's resilient and we've got all the, thousands of years. This is just something someone cooked up in a lab. And so as soon as that water goes over, that thing's dead. And then it doesn't matter what happened with the flood damage. San Francisco will become toxic and extraordinarily dangerous in a very short period of time, because all their waste, their human manure, all that stuff will start piling up, and they have no place to store it. So then it would either back up into the city, or they would just let release it into the water, and then, you know what I mean? So it's a crazy, hysterically irresponsible situation that we kind of find ourselves in. And it's kind of like our generation is walking in and turning on the lights. And we're like, okay, we're ready to, what are you guys doing? And they're like doing the most hysterically stupid, inappropriate, criminal, like you name it, it's on the list.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really on us. The onus is on us. No one's going to protect your family. No, I mean, you look at the footage of Portland police and how they're reacting with like Antifa with beating up journalists now in America. It's like, they're not doing anything. They're afraid. When the police are afraid, when the mayors are afraid, when our, like, we are in a such a tenuous situation, all we need is one of these larger blackouts to hit in one of the entire coasts, and we're going to see riots. We're going to see real scary stuff happen, unless we've got food storage, unless we have a 72-hour kit. Some people call them bug out kits. When I joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I learned about food storage, having a 2-year supply. I learned about having a 72-hour kit so that if anything happens, you just get up and go. And it was like normal. And now everyone's talking about it, and it's like people really want to know about this stuff. And for me, we've been like, you know, changing out the food storage, and hard times came and we ate into our food storage, saving money, right? And we've been living this. And then when I started gardening, it was like, this is the living food storage. This is the real food storage, because as many of you know, number one, most of the food storage stuff isn't very high quality. Number two, if you go through Azure Standard, which is superb, you get higher quality, right? You can get organic food storage. You can seal it all yourself and everything. But then it's still dry goods. And if you live on dry goods, especially like with the bread and all that kind of stuff, and your body doesn't like you after a while. It's like, okay, I'm not even done. And so it's really about that garden. It's about that living food storage, your seed bank. It's about that, like, and not even just like living food storage, like you have your perennial trees, but I would have, you know, hundreds of pounds of squash that will last over a year long outside, no covering, just under an awning in California. Meanwhile, it's like hot out, right? But the food is there. It's like, that's the actual food storage. It's like, yeah, the stuff inside, you know, it'll keep me alive. But the nutritional quality is just night and day. And sure, we're getting the einkorn, we're getting the ancient flour, we're getting all the things, but nonetheless, there is nothing compared to a fresh food diet, fresh meat diet. Having that kind of connection and immediacy to your food is critically important. And yes, no, fermenting your foods and you partnering with fungi and all that is really critical too, especially for folks like me that need help digesting, so that pre-digestion really can help. But nonetheless, the fresh food diet, as we've looked and seen in indigenous peoples and their gut biome, is the most diverse and is the most resilient. So that's my story and why I got to this point where I'm an advocate for gardening, an advocate for preparedness, for resiliency, for protecting our families in a decentralized, community interdependent based way. Because as you know, and if you haven't thought about it, maybe you don't know, but if you have the best garden, you got all the food storage, you got everything, and your neighbors got nothing, and your neighbors have guns, and your neighbors are starving, it's going to be a problem. And so it's incredibly important that now we give those cuttings, those rooted cuttings to our neighbor and say, just plant this and you'll have strawberries next year. And they'll be like, oh, okay. do I water it? And go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And check on it every once in a while, maybe. But like, think of those things as the buffers on your system. Your neighbors literally become your allies in that potential, and it's not so potential, I mean, it's probable, and it's going to happen at some point. We're going to have a collapse of our systems or a serious hiccup, and we're all going to have to reevaluate how we do things. But preemptively, we can put these things into place, and those people, if they recognize you have the value, and not only that, you can set them up quickly, easily, it's not hard, they're going to, instead of come to you, give me your food, they're going to be like, I'm here to work. I'm here to protect the food. It's our food together. And they're going to be on the team. And then their land is going to be our land. And you're going to be able to plant out your border will suddenly shift and your zone two will just, you know. But that's how it was in California for me. I realized that all of my neighbors were the extensions of my own system. And we were all interdependent in reality, especially because when you look at the larger scheme of things, there is going to be people going around doing bad things. You know what I mean? Invariably. And it will be those strong, resilient, interdependent, connected communities that protect themselves. But enough Mad Max. The way to start out all this really is to start dealing properly with our waste. Because you could go out and plant seeds right now in your lawn and it won't go so well. But if we bring in the biology, we start building soil as a habit, you'll just start putting it out there and it'll want to grow. And it's a clean slate when it's compost. So you can be removing that turf layer and then mixing in compost. And then you've got this rich, awesome medium in which to plant. And then your garden's continuously expanding. You're always being able to enrich, feed, treat, and maybe even heal parts of your garden and scaling it up. I mean, when you're doing cuttings, most of the time you're doing them in sharp sand so that the water runs really fast through it. And you're just spraying with compost tea. So there's just amount of life to give it that housing, to give it that amount of nutrition and cycling through the economy. And so you're just teasing it out and it's following that root path and creating a great root zone. So having that compost, tea is the best starting point. And that's 30%. Like 30% of the problem of our waste that goes into the landfills is organic matter. It just turns into methane. Stinks. I mean, remember when we drove by the landfill when we were kids and it stunk so bad? That's all of our food waste, which could be gold, which could be like all the fertility in our gardens. And so if we don't let it leave, and if you're like, oh man, I'm in an apartment, Matt, I can't compost. I've seen those Dr. Lane Ingham videos and the whole thing. Or I've got a bad shoulder. I'm a disabled vet, Matt. I can't do that. You know, I've got all sorts of students. And the reality is, if you're partnering with the microbiology, if you're using effective microbes, you can make it so that you turn it less. You could make it so that you basically turn it never, depending on your concentrations and how you're loading it in. Like, let's say you got a bokashi bucket. You put in your organic waste. You put in some bokashi, which is inoculated organic matter. And then they pair with it. There's enough carbon in there to deal with all the nitrogen. The EM actually is fermenting the nitrogen into amino acids for you, which are immediately uptakeable by plants.
Let me stop you for 1 second so we can define bokashi for folks who've never heard that
term. Okay. Bokashi is just a term that means, it just means organic matter, composted organic matter. And it's from Japan and it's basically really simple. This way of dealing with compost on your kitchen counter without it stinking. And so bokashi is this incredible, bokashi is just the organic matter inoculated with EM, which are effective microbes, which are yeast, which we know, which are LAB, which is lactic acid bacteria, like lactobacillus is one of the ones we know pretty commonly. And so like we're talking about pickling, we're talking about fermenting like wines and stuff like that. And then third, we're talking about purple non-sulfur bacteria. And there are more in the consortium, but these are the main three. And purple non-sulfur bacteria feeds four different ways. It can feed off light. It's really, truly remarkable. It's found in the digestion of earthworms. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is essentially and it's also found in manure lagoons. It's found in like toxic waste dumps. So it can eat very exotic, very difficult things. And so that's why EM is used for treating and remediating areas that have been abused. And so it takes those nitritous compounds and it ferments them. So instead of that stink, instead of the huge heat from the nitrogen that would come off of a hot compost, it doesn't go above 129, 131 at max. And I've done this. And it's really powerful. Let's say you've got a chicken coop. Your wife's really mad at you. Your chicken coop stinks. You don't want to go and shovel it out. Let's say you don't even have more straw. And it just stinks. It's hot. The wind is blowing it into your house. You're in all sorts of trouble. But you got biochar and you got EM. You go out there, you throw the biochar down. Maybe you stomp it in a bit. And then you spray that EM. And what will happen is the EM will provide the biochar will provide housing for the EM and the other life that's present. And then all those nitrogenous stinky compounds will start to be fermented, will start to be turned into amino acids.
I did lose your audio just now. This does tie back. So, yeah, let me try and catch up with a bunch of things you've said while you're adjusting your audio. But, yeah, speaking of the most inappropriate things we could possibly do in terms of our agriculture, you know, it's common ground when you look back at indigenous cultures that they're frequently referencing. We need to be taking care of things with seven generations ahead of us in mind. And you're right, as our generation is collectively flipping on the lights right now, that is certainly not what we're finding. It's this toxic thing. It's just amazing the way you described it quite well, that it's just the most toxic thing you could do on both sides. We've got, without that closed loop, and frequently people think, well, I'm composting, you know, my greens now, I'm doing some chop and drop, so I've closed that loop. And that's somewhat true. You can sort of, it's like the rising vibes of it. You can sort of feel what it feels like when you start to see those nutrients cycling in the virtuous cycle through your site. But right, I'm glad you brought up human urine, which is really the, you know, if you're growing food and then eating it, that's, you've got to close that cycle. So it's good to bring that up.
So for me, EM was a game changer when I learned about that. And that's why I always talk about it. And then bokashi really is like a secondary layer. I don't actually do the bucket thing. I've got a big compost out back. I'm always adding to it. I'm always trying to brew more EM. I'm also brewing kefir, which is very much like EM, very similar. And for years, before I heard about EM, I was adding that to my compost teas and adding that to my compost. And it's, I mean, there's yeasts in it. There's over two dozen different members of the consortium that makes the kefir grain. So it's really fascinating. It's found actually at the top all over the world, above 2,000 feet. Most commonly, it's found at the heads of springs, these kefir grains. And so the yogis, the wise men, the shamans, they would be up at these top of the mountains, at these pure mountain streams, because they could bottle the herbs with the kefir grains in them, and then they would make fizzy drinks, these medicinal concoctions. And the biology actually pulls the compounds out and makes them more digestible. So suddenly that medicine, that bitter, you're pulling it out, you're combining with all these different things, And then it's able to really incorporate into your body at a higher level. So I was doing that with soil life without even realizing it for a long time. And then I learned about EM, which is a much more focused, something that actually comes from the tradition, according to Cuauhtémoc Villa, who is one of the first people trained in this and how to make EM 20 years ago. So he told me when I was interviewing him that EM was discovered when Japanese researchers were studying Terra preta in the Brazilian rainforest. And that what they discovered was that the pottery shards and then the Terra preta itself had specific life in it that you just didn't find in the native soils. And so they basically took it back to them and started playing with all the different consortiums they found. And then Bokashi and Dr. Higa says he was playing around with all these different things and discovered this because he dumped it out and it made that area grow really well. So there's a bunch, it's hard to track exactly for me from the research that I've seen and the people I've talked to. There's a lot of threads that are involved, but we have a tradition here of using biology to break down matter faster than it can decompose naturally. And whether you're in San Francisco in the sewage waste municipality with the GMO, or you're in the Amazon digging up terra preta and you're finding pottery shards, fish bones, human manure, biochar, and all the food scraps and everything that went into that, there's this common thread that we're using biology to pre-digest or fully decompose organic matter in order to serve us and the environment around us. So I highly recommend diving into that and exploring that, because a lot of people see compost, they say, I tried a compost heap, I can see this, the same stuff I put into it last year is still there. It's just sitting there. You know, there are things you can do. Make the pile taller, maybe make a pit, dig it up, dig a pit and put it down in the pit. If you're in a drier climate, because that's what can happen. You can preserve things in those drier climates. But partner with the biology, speed up the decomposition, pre-digestion, those kinds of things of the process so that you can really make that compost happen quickly. EM1 by Terragenics or Terragenics. One of those names. If you just type EM, or effective microbes, into Amazon, I don't know if you have an Amazon partner page that you can post. But that is a really powerful way to start, because my book, which you can download for free, has the recipe to take that one purchase and never buy it again. Mm-hmm. And so you can always scale it up with a little bit of molasses, a little bit of EM, water in a sealed container. So it's really not hard. It's really easy. I know I went all over the map and everything, but hopefully I circled back enough to emphasize that just composting, dealing with our waste in a positive manner, is so powerful. And if you're afraid of human manure, make sure you have the EM first. And also animal bedding pellets. You can get one of those little camping toilet seats, put it on a bucket, and just use that and just add animal bedding pellets and spray it with EM. And guess what? It will literally not be the same thing. It will not be as stinky. You can use biochar too, throw it in there and really take away the stink. But the compost that you're going to get out of it is extremely, extremely powerful, because humans have very high nitrogen manure. And that means that you combine that with a lot of carbon and you get a lot of compost. So it's really exciting on many levels, because the potential is ridiculously high. It's like, you know, the oceans. The oceans and potential for food, for fuel, for just you name it, right? Is through the roof. It's a solution that's just waiting for us, just like this. So I would say start with that. Make the soil happen. And then as you're making these things happen, you're going to be like, I have to find a place to put this soil. and it will literally force you. And I love this. I do this all the time to myself. I put myself into a corner with good things. So I'm like forced to go and now do that good thing. And so I've got like all this soil. It's a wonderful blessing. And now I've got to go put it out. And then you got this blessing outside and you're like, well, I should just plant in it. And then you planted it. And then you're like, oh man, I got this great thing growing outside. I better water it. And it just becomes this obligatory train of events. And you end up living into that thing that you really wanted to do, but it maybe seems like so many steps away and it's difficult. Just start here and the inevitable process will start and lead you into it.
Mm-hmm. And another thing, and this is particularly true of the American culture, I feel like sometimes, is there are so many products out there that we just see. For one, I couldn't possibly even figure out what to choose. And so this is another reason I couldn't, you know, I'm not a gardener. I don't understand all those things. It's another layer of like feeling like you need to understand things. And then even more so, it's expensive. If you actually think that you need to go out and buy all these things constantly, or worse yet, every year and do it, you know, fresh, then of course there's a huge, you know, cost barrier to entry. You were mentioning the lactobacillus, and of course, Chris Trump has a great, you know, primer on how to how to bring this up and start that process. And it's very, you know, it's basically costless. You've got milk going bad or some rice that you start from, and this is how you get the most amazing results. I've just gotten tremendous results from this. It's very surprising. And you can keep these cultures going. Go ahead.
Yeah, Chris Trump's recipe is the recipe in my book.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, Chris is a good friend. Chris is a wonderful guy. He actually has two farms, which is really, really, really cool to see, because most people are doing like farming or have their techniques and they're pigeonholed to a certain bioregion. But Chris is in Hawaii, in a macadamia nut farm, a perennial commercial operation. And then he's in Idaho. So he's like in the complete opposite, doing the same exact things, doing the same Korean natural farming and getting unbelievable results in both locations, such that he can bounce between both locations and handle both fertility and pest control on both farms himself.
That's fantastic. And so the EM there, just we defined bokashi. So the EM are effective microorganisms, right? This is you breeding the life that you're going to be bringing into your soil. And it's not really, I mean, it's not fair to call this a fertilizer, because it's not like mm-hmm. you're just feeding the plants, but you are sending an army of awesome little friends into the soil to work with the plants that you're going to put in there. And then you feed these little guys. You know, I don't know, lots of people say, in fact, Elaine Ingram, says not to use molasses. What's your take on feeding soil life with, you know, with sugar, with molasses?
Yeah, so it's interesting because the Korean natural farmers use it a lot, right, in different preps. Elaine uses it too. It just depends on what she's doing. So for instance, when she moved on to that farm that had all those evergreens, it was so acidic, and they'd use so much Roundup that she was definitely using molasses to up the bacterial side of things so that it would tip it that direction, and that it would also digest the Roundup. Because she's told me before that Roundup is actually a bacterial food, and that's part of the reason why when they spray it, it actually creates weeds coming back. Because it's leaning towards the bacterial side of things, which is more towards weeds and basically it's more towards the beginning of the succession. It's more towards opportunistic and we got an established area. We got to, it's weedy, but it's also reparative. It's also invasive. It's introductory species. It's that edge of things. Is a great way to think about it. And she also says, you know, that every soil has everything on the planet for any plant. But that's not exactly true. It, in general, when you look at the agricultural soils, is true from the testing that's been done. And that's according to Professor David R. Montgomery, author of The Hidden Half of Nature and Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. There's a great talk I did with, or interview I did with him, where he talks about, you know, I mean, sand is basically like oxygen and what's the other element? Anyway, he's like, basically it's like silica and oxygen. There you go. He's like, there's nothing there. It's like, there's no everything. There can't be. And so we have to just recognize that. And then Dan Kittredge, that I was talking to when I was interviewing him, said that the thing with that testing from that book, which I have right there, Environmental Chemistry of Soils, they were going 20 feet deep. So if your soils have an anaerobic layer that was caused by tillage pressure, creating that hard pan, then there's no accessing that layer below it with all the other stuff in it. And then that top layer could have been mined by you constantly taking the food out of it, spraying it constantly. And so it could actually be lacking in certain things, specifically in the tropics, specifically in places like Australia, where it's hyper brittle, this can happen. And so certain elements, which when I learned this, blew my mind. I'm getting all nerdy, but cobalt. And this is the reason why we have to have rock dust. And I'm gonna edit my book and add rock dust into it in the third edition, because without cobalt, all life like doesn't have access to B12. And not saying that every single thing that lives needs B12, but animals sure do. We need B12, even the little itty bitty ones. So the soil food web animals all the way up to us, we need B12. And the centerpiece of the B12 molecule is cobalt. So wonderful thing about cobalt, it's in all the indigenous rocks. So you just get indigenous rock dust from wherever you are in the world. Doesn't have to be a ton. And just having that cycling in the soil will allow you to support your compost when you put it into your soil, so that your soil doesn't basically kill your compost. Because if your compost gets out there and they're like, wait a second, there's cobalt. 80% of the compost life will die. And that's according to Dan Kittredge, creator of the bio-nutrient meter, which is way better than BRICS. A lot of people, you know, are imagining BRICS meters are going to take off. The over 100-year-old technology. The bio-nutrient meters is going to be the future. We'll be able to walk through the grocery store and know exactly which tomatoes are the healthiest, exactly which watermelon, without even cutting it or messing it up or anything. You'll be able to know. So yeah, there's a lot of caveats to all this, but most of this stuff is pretty easy to get through. I mean, we're talking about composting. We're talking about having rock dust. We're talking about, you know, using EM. And if you've ever brewed beer or kefir or mead or something like that, it's about as hard as that or a little bit less hard.
Yeah.
So this isn't hard stuff to do. So yeah, I would say start with that. Start with making the compost happen, and you will find that this stuff is fun. It's just like making a batch of cookies, or brewing some meat or something like that, and the results are so ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean, you just see your plants rebound. You see the disease go down. You see your plants get. I mean, I have that famous video of my amaranth plant. It's my most popular video on my channel, the Permaculture Student. And they're like they're 10, 12 feet tall amaranth plants. No one's seen this before. And there's some of their bases are this thick around, and it's because the soil is so healthy. And if the soil wasn't healthy, I wouldn't be able to do any of the things I do in the garden. We'd be able to have good food. So without that foundation, it doesn't really matter where you go. And you can build up with just seeds and hand tools and stuff too. I've done that too. But you're denying yourself your greatest weapon in your arsenal if you're not turning your personal waste into soil.
Yeah. it's fighting an uphill battle. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we mentioned, you know, obviously organic matter is coming from these composting practices that we were describing. Bacteria, we're going to be farming and then putting into the EM, some of the Bokashi. Do we need to, you mentioned the soil food web, so I pulled this up and I wanted to ask, do we need to be aware of some of these other guys, or do we just, by following these good practices, implicitly treat the rest of these guys well?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because a lot of us want microscopes and we want to go to the nth degree. And the reality is, you go to the nth degree in the microscopic world and you discover what all the experts have discovered. We don't know anything. We know that they're there. We know that they're interacting. And we have classified them into these groups of like arthropods, which just means jointed legs. Okay. So, and then the nematodes are worms. So we've classified them. We've noted these interactions and we know of some of the things that they're doing that as well. Actually, the nervous system of a certain type of nematode was only mapped this last year. And that was actually last week's cover article of Nature magazine. It was the worm wide web or something like that. But we really are early days with this. I mean, fungi is only, like, mycology is only a 70-year-old science. So we're just getting into this. I get really into all this kind of stuff and I've studied it a lot and I think it's super cool, but you don't need to know all of it. You don't need to have a microscope. You don't need to be worrying about your protozoa and nematodes if you're bringing in that compost regularly. You just don't need to worry about it.
Perfect.
The moles and the birds, I might worry about them. And maybe you, the listeners might not. And so a lot of people see those moles as a problem. But I'm here to tell you that their manure pellets are incredibly important. And they're aerating the soil and they're creating free irrigation, you know, underground irrigation for you. And you're like, but will they ever go away? I've been battling them for 10 years. That means your soil's not good. I'm sorry. Because as soon as your soil hits a certain loamy level where it's squishy, they can't handle that because the integrity of their tunnels is gone. Every time you pass through the garden, their tunnels are screwed up. And so they just move on into an area which has more stability. And that's why they really like hugel cultures, actually. So be aware of that when you're creating a big stick pile and covering it with dirt, that's like a ground squirrel-like habitat paradise at the hotel. Because you've got hard structure that protects them. So that's one of the things I learned. But yeah, I would say that you don't need to worry about it. It's really about letting nature take the stage and about us being the picture frame on a new story. And when we're that kind of facilitator, it's like watching your kids like grow up and then become adults. And you're like, holy cow, how did this happen? It's like your seeds will do the same thing. And you'll be like, oh my word, how is this way? All I did was set the stage. And I did the same thing last year, but without the compost or without the EM or whatever. And it was nothing like this. And it's about providing that stage so that life can start doing it, because we can't. It's so funny that, you know, we keep trying to create machines that outdo photosynthesis when it's a free process. Nature just does it automatically. It's just ludicrous that we try to continuously technologically replace nature when if we just pair technology with nature, we'd be in such a different stratosphere.
Yeah, it does seem to be a singular way of using technology to replace God's creation. But let's put that aside. One thing we've acknowledged but not talked much about is the fungi. It's important on that food web. We all know it's super important. We all know we get better results when we use the mycorrhizal fungi. Is there a way, because the Korean natural farming way of creating that lactobacillus, the EMs from nothing, it feels like magic and it's super cheap. How do we do that for fungi without just going down and buying mycos?
So what's really interesting about Korean natural farming is it's basically the preps, the IMO, indigenous microorganism preps, IMOs 1 through 5, which Chris has as videos, and they're also described in my book. They're like doing mycology in mushroom cultivation without a lab and without a sterile space. So, a sterile field, I should say. But it's like they're doing all this stuff, but the microbiology is indigenous. So there's no worry about contamination. You want the contamination because that's the indigenous microbiology. And they're taking waste products. They're taking, problem products, and they're actually fermenting them in place sometimes on the ground on a tarp. So it's so amazing to see, Chris go through these preps and how macro they are in relation to what we're doing, like in a little laboratory setting with growing mushrooms or liquid culture mycelium. I would say that's kind of like the fail safe is using the indigenous microorganisms of your area. And I mean that because of a whole bunch of things. Number one, so many of the mycorrhizal inoculants in the stores have the full spectrum. They have endo, they have ecto, and it's like, does it really work that way? And it, like, because certain plants just prefer endo, certain plants just prefer ecto, certain plants prefer both. And then there's also arguments like Michael Phillips saying that, like, we don't really know the full extent to that caveat. Yeah, so endo means that it's going into the root, inside the root cell walls. They're all going inside the roots. The plant gives permission for the fungi to enter it and partner with it and then become an extension of the root. And so most of the stuff that we're actually talking about that is the most effective mycorrhizal inoculants are actually AMF, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, which partners with over 90% of plants and it has no known ancestor and collects nuclei. And so we have no way of actually classifying it because we painted ourselves into a corner with the way we do things. And we decided that nuclei was how we defined the animal or plant or something like that. But the reality is that the nuclei are the reproductive memory. It's like the reproduction. It's like, as one scientist put it, he said it's the gonads. It's you've got all these like science men going around getting confused between their different brains and looking at the gonads and being like, well, that's the brain. So, but anyway, but yeah, I mean, like literally, like that's not the brain. The nucleus is not the brain. And we've thought about it as the brain for so long that now we're in serious trouble because AMF collects 800 to 1200 different nuclei from different species. And so in the spores it releases, it's actually modulating constantly like a permanently modulating like analog keyboard or something like that. And every time it comes out, it synthesizes. Every time it comes out with a new consortium of life that's calibrated to the level of succession. So there's this fungi that, and people are, that's what a lot of these inoculants are it's AMF, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. And it's called arbuscular because it makes a tree inside of the plant cell. And it's going around for only a few days to 2 weeks. It shows up and disappears. This is, again, part of the, you know, the, this is, we don't talk about these things in school because, I mean, it ends up leading to faith for a lot of people. Because there's like, oh, well, thermophilic microbes aren't there until you get hot. And then they appear. And then they go away when it gets cold. Where did they go? Where were they? And so we don't really know. And it's stunning. So, and endomycorrhizae, they're the annuals. They're most of the perennials, like all the fruiting things, including even hemp and cacao, willows. Ecto, very small. So we're talking about further on down in succession: Douglas fir, alder, pine, poplar, manzanita, beech, and chestnut. And then both ecto and endo, it's even smaller, like eucalyptus, poplar, willow, aspen, cottonwood, and alder. And then there's a few that are neither, which, and this is information from Fungi Perfecti, which is Paul Stamets. Every section of my book, I can tell you exactly where it's from because I cite it all. And you can go and read the citations too and read the original document because we got to do this now, right? The internet and all the wonderful fact checking we've done has prepared us for this, I do believe. But what's so crazy cool about this is my third edition, I'm going to talk about how certain brassicas actually do pair with fungi. So, like, for instance, elm, oyster, mushrooms pair with brassicas, and we don't know why. And that just showed up, and they figured out that blueberries actually, because I said blueberries don't there too, but they've just recently figured out that blueberries pair with a certain type of fungi. It begins with an E. I can't remember it exactly, or I can remember it in a butchered way, but I don't want to butcher that word and then have my mycologist friends be like, Matt, what were you doing?
But I want to again ask that question. How much of this, if we're following good soil practices, how much of this do we need to know?
I think that for most of us, it won't matter, but I've learned there are so many of us that are on a marginal land. Yeah. So many of us are being able to buy only in areas where the land's destroyed. Or we're out in the middle of like the high desert, or you know what I mean? And that's just where we are. And so I always kind of mention those outliers because I get those outliers being like, dude, I've tried everything. It's just a lie, you know? And so it's like, I really feel for those people. And so I always try to throw in those caveats in there so that those people who are working with really poor soils are like, why aren't my blueberries working? You know what I mean? It's like the acidity is right. I don't know what's going on. And it's like, well, maybe get some of that inoculant. That very specific blueberry inoculant. Ericosi, something like that. But you could just Google it. I mean, like I could Google it right now. Blueberry fungi.
I'm out here right now, right next to one of these Demeter certified farms, which is a biodynamic farm. And it's fascinating mm-hmm. to walk through.
Ericacea.
Okay. Say it again.
Oh, no. The family is Ericacea. Let me find this. Yeah. So they need a very specific fungi. I'm not going to take our time to look for it. But the fact is, and then you look at like all orchids, they all need a fungal partner. So people, if they're trying to grow orchids, if you don't have the fungal partner, they won't grow. They've recently discovered that you can actually partner reishi mushrooms with orchids. So the discoveries keep happening and the benefits keep compounding, which seems like it just doesn't make sense, right, to the 80s mind, to the 80s mindset, that we were like, we're still discovering new angles to our food, to our plants, to new compounds that they're creating. I have one teacher that was talking about how they were spraying, it's actually Organics Alive, they were spraying this compost tea on these plants, and these plants got like 5 buds per bud spur. And that had never happened in the history of that plant. And they thought it was a mutant. They thought that actually their spray had mutated the crop and everyone was in trouble. And they like looked at it and basically they had taken it up to the genetic full expression of the plant. And in my mind, I'm like, that's where I want to live.
Yeah.
At the genetic fullest expression of myself.
Nice.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I would say that all these kind of caveats, they only matter when you encounter them. And I mention them as like seeds so that later on, if you're doing this stuff, you have all this great success, but then there's this one thing. You're like, instead of you thinking you're bad or wrong or anything like that, it's like, wait a second, there's something going on here and I can figure it out. Because the internet's so full of information now. And a lot of, you know, I mean, most of the information is behind closed doors on the internet, no doubt. But we have so much access to the information. So many people are making it more widely available. I'm trying to make it more widely available because this stuff is a human right, how to live, the processes. And as you say, knowing these names, these details is not as important as just making it a habit, doing these things in our regular lives. And maybe you can't grow blueberries in your area. Maybe that's a good thing. You know what I mean? we can't grow everything everywhere, anywhere, all the time. And I think that that's kind of like the root problem of that soil idea, like soil concept that everything is everything. Is because it's kind of like an on-demand thing for us. It's kind of like, well, I want everything and anything when I want it. And it's like, that's not the way it really works if you want to that best, fullest extent. So yeah, lean into things and follow your observation. You're going to recognize certain plants are doing extraordinarily well. You're going to recognize certain foods make you feel really good. And it's following those pathways and following that, you know, research and scientific study that is going to lead you to that higher expression.
And feeling good.
And that's what, and that's why I see all these as a tool, you know, towards doing, unlocking our greatness, unlocking that highest level of genetic expression.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by following that process, feeling what it is your body needs is really how you unlock your best potential. And I love that. So you can actually improve your own, you know, improve your own life and the way you feel and your results of whatever you're investing your efforts into on a daily basis, but also mitigate these fears. You know, so we've talked about the fact that a good biological agent can actually go in and neutralize glyphosate, which is, you know, if you look at literally the way that glyphosates are pictured out there on the Roundup is pictured out there on the internet. It's just, oh, they're spraying death and we're all going to die. And it's just the end of the story, right? It's just a full stop. We must get rid of Monsanto. But if you can embrace, and similarly, I was going to say, you know, you mentioned California literally sinking into the ground in the Central Valley because we're extracting. And I was going to mention that I'm walking by these biodynamic farms where there are roadways, you know, because these are hundreds of years old villages and towns around here. So there's roadways that have been there. And the farm, they're like little valleys around the farm now, because the farm is following these biodynamic practices that build and build and build the soil. And they're now a full meter plus higher than the street where they had started, because they just keep building this soil. And it's fantastic to see. And I know there's a lot of similarities between the biodynamic preparations and some of the stuff that goes in there, and then Korean natural farming, and of course in other indigenous practices, because we're all, you know, different languages of these core truths of enabling, like you said, get out of the way and let nature take over here. So I just wanted to stress that I love the way that this is, you know, everybody knows knowledge is power. Knowledge is going to empower you, but it also makes your life better and helps you assuage these concerns, helps get away from fear and take it into really empowering you to find these solutions. I want to empower people who are catching this, that maybe this is their first exposure to the whole idea of growing your own food. And they have a lot, like you said, a lot of people have marginal soils. So we've sort of touched around without doing it explicitly giving people instructions. We've mentioned these practices of bokashi, fermenting things, EM, biochar, a lot of these things. Do you have a canonical, here's your getting your garden started. Of course, composting is on this list. What advice do you give for someone who wants to go out and just start repairing that land that first season and get their zone one going?
Yeah, so I always try to do things in spectrums. So I tend not to do like a one size fits all.
Uh-huh, sure. That's why it's a hard question, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So for instance, like for some people, they might have a lawn and then they go out there and they would just peel that lawn back. They would lay down seed. They would aerate it maybe with a broad fork. They would lay down seed like the five cousins. So we're talking about a nitrogen fixer like cowpeas, something super vigorous. We're talking about a C4 grass like sorghum. And something to bring in pollinators and birds, specifically small birds. If you have tons of small little birds, they just bring in tons of manure. And I think that the bigger birds do so much damage. The small birds are really good and they like amaranth. So I do the amaranth. And then bringing in the phosphorus and scrounging up all the nitrogen, storing it, and then allowing it to go back into organic matter with daikon radish. That's also biological tillage. And then buckwheat. Of course, buckwheat. Buckwheat is the accelerant. Buckwheat is the catalyst here because buckwheat makes your nitrogen fixation go double. So the cowpeas end up fixing twice as much nitrogen because the buckwheat steals from them. And then because it's twice as much nitrogen, the economy is going to twice as much, which means the growth is going twice as much because they're splitting everything they're doing in the photosynthetic process. They're like, okay, I'm gonna take some to my growth and some to the nodulation. And so that they'll make amino acids so that I can get the overflow of amino acids. And then make proteins. And that's what actually forms the protein in the bean, in the peas. And so those five workers, I essentially bring in and then they just go nuts. They occupy all the space. They're like a cover crop, like times 10, because they go up in the air. They're scaffolding all over each other. It creates this multi-canopy experience. The air is totally different down in the lower canopies. The temperatures are totally different. The processes and the cladding of the soil life are extremely protected. And so you end up with a major change in the soil just from them being there. And then you chop and drop them at the end of the season and have that all just break down in place over winter, and in the fall, you've got a clean, in the spring next year, you've got a clean slate. So because you might even leave the seeds on there and then it can regrow and then you can eat it the next year, but chopping and dropping, maybe saving the seeds, you end up, especially if you take the seeds away, you end up with a completely bare, clean slate. And if at different times it's dropping too low and you're like, it's just bare ground, you just put some straw over it to continue covering it and feeding the life as it digests and forms that topsoil. And so yeah, that's what I would highly recommend to everyone to start out doing and making it super easy. I've also done things where I've literally taken the grass down super low and then just chopped it up and then aerated it and planted in that. I've also even grown among some weeds, and that only works with certain plants that are really, really vigorous that can grow among weeds. Usually it's beans, something that has enough. The thing is, the bean size, the pea size, has so much energy in it. That's why it's a big seed, which allows it to put a root down far enough and allows it to grow high enough, still existing on that same packet of food. So that's why certain things can leg out and find soil with their root out of seed and you throw salt, and some things can't. So yeah, I would totally recommend diving deep into building soil, whether you're planting it out, whether you're growing it in a compost, you know, or building it in a compost heap. But that soil is always what I recommend first, because after that, it's easy. It's like running downhill. You just throw the seeds out on that and it grows. And if your seeds are trained properly, it does that. I mean, if you are buying seed from just a regular seed house, their seeds are grown in the most ideal wet climate. You probably aren't in the most ideal climate for that seed. And so it has to adapt. So once your seeds are really adapted, you can just throw them around and then they just grow like hotcakes. But it really has to have that setting, that context. It's like children, you know what I mean? It's like you put them into a school with no resources, they're going to struggle. You put them into a school where they're like, oh, we just facilitate here and we provide state-of-the-art this and that. You can do whatever you want, child, but we're here to help. It's like that kid's going to go like rockets, you know? So it's the same context with the soil. And then, you know, going further, let's say you already have good soil. Let's say you already have a garden, because most of the people that actually get involved have been tinkering a while. Even if they say they aren't gardening, they aren't saying they're gardening because they're not a gardener yet, identity-wise. They haven't had that win. And so they've been tinkering, and they sometimes have some, like, upsetness and everything. But it really... At that point, it really is about understanding like how to feed your plants. And that is like, again, the soil, because unless they're cycling, they don't get the nutrition. It's the economy, the cycles that gives them the nutrition. And so then I would be talking about EM, compost teas, and then maybe even, and especially this year, I don't know if you've noticed, but usually like in California, it's so hot and so sunny that your plants in the shade are growing like great. But that's not so much the case this year, which is really interesting. It's been colder, but I wonder if it's like literally like have you in your research with the sun, is the sun like dimmer? Because I mean, I know I haven't had any sunspots, but it's like my shade plants are spindly in California, and my shade plants usually aren't spindly. And yeah, the soil that I just moved on to, you know what I mean, isn't so good. But I'm just wondering about your experience and what you've been hearing from your listeners.
I personally, I'm having better luck with stuff that's like partially in the shade. So if it's in full sun, it's just too much where I am. It gets burned or can't handle that. So things that are or just spends all of its energy dealing with it, I think is probably what's going on there.
Yeah.
And transpiring. So stuff that's like getting shade in the afternoons, but getting that good morning sun is really doing the best. That's where things, that's like the prime zone for me. So if I can find a zone that's got afternoon shade, but full morning sun. And so
that's it. Yeah, that's my experience.
Interesting. Yeah. So definitely the sun's output is changing in a number of ways. Some people are noticing that there's changes in the UV output, increases in the UV and even in UVC reaching the surface, which is not good for anything, including plants. But I think it's hard to say. Yeah.
Yeah. It is really hard to say. I mean, I was talking to someone in Pennsylvania and it's like, you know, it's not too far from like several states that are like having like crazy problems with corn. And they were talking about how they're growing my purple speckled corn and it's going great. And it's like Pennsylvania is turning into this hot rainforest for them in their area. And I'm like, that's crazy. They're like, I know, I've been hearing about all the cold in like the state right there.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's like, we have serious strange things going on. I mean, the fact that like it was colder in Washington at different times than it was at the North Pole, colder in Washington at different times in Alaska. There is no certainty. And I don't think any expert can tell us like what's going on. They can only observe and be like, it's like the thing with the nematodes, right? It's like we've arrived at the limits of our understanding and we're like, yeah, that's the worms and those are the ones with the legs that are jointed and that's definitely fungi and that's bacteria. Who are they? We don't know. There's 100,000 of those. There's 3 million of those. There's, you know what I mean? It's like the sophistication isn't there. And so for me, it's really, like you said, the flip side of that. What can I do? Mm-hmm. What's something that's knowable and a doable? And so I really think that at this time, I think it's about getting those seeds in the ground. Someone asked me yesterday, like, why are you growing food so late in the season? Why are you growing food that you know might fail or in bad soils? Why are you even bother growing in bad soils? Why don't you go buy some soil? You know what I mean? And it's like, first of all, how do you know what you're deficient unless you like participate with the soil? And it's like, yeah, you can do the soluble, like little soil tests. That's only the soluble nutrients. That's not the actual nutrients. It's just another one of those like, you know, cheap, like little tricks that we, you know what I mean? That we play on ourselves. That's actually a good trick though. The knowing the actual clay, sand, and silt. Mm-hmm. Because if you've got all clay, you can start doing some adobe huts. And then also realize that your soil is going to have very particular properties. Mm-hmm. Once that gets saturated, it will hold water for extended periods of time, like a bank, like a battery. Yeah. But once it gets dry, it will be hydrophobic and resistant to hydration. So this is really a good soil test. But the ones that are like the colorful NPK ones that we get from the stores, they're only showing you like a little fraction of what's possible. So I always partner with life. I'm always using the plants to kind of create this dialogue with that local area. And whether it's deficient or not, I get that information. And I have so many seeds. I mean, I've got bins and bins of seeds. And it's not a big deal for me to lose seeds in an experiment, in a dialogue, because first of all, seeds are so high in nitrogen and carbon that they're actually like fertilizer. I mean, that's why people are doing seed teas, you know? The exudates that come off seeds are crazy too. So they're jump-starting the life just by doing that. The exudates are basically the sugars and a little bit of protein, but they're basically sugars that are coming out of the plant that attract life. Mm-hmm. And if you get a lot of those, I mean, I at one point was chopping corn down next to corn because I knew that corn that I was chopping would go, and put out tons of exudates to try to get help. To regrow, because they're grass, they resprout. It's not like it's going to resprout and then give you nice ears or something like that, but it resprouts, and in that process it's sending out so much into the soil. It's like dumping into the soil messages that are going to make your soil unbelievably awesome. So I do a lot of things where people are like, why are you doing that, Matt? But it's all so I build that soil. So I set the context so that whatever I do, I can do it well or not so well. It'll grow fine because that soil food web and that context is so great.
So you've mentioned compost teas, and that aligns with one question that I got from a folk in Ice Age Farmer Discord who was wondering very explicitly, what is your practice for compost teas? I guess, A, what do you make it with? And then B, when during the day and during the season do you apply it? Is there a best time of day? And just all of these sorts of questions around compost tea.
Yeah, so as soon as I have good compost, I'll start making compost tea because I'm remediating a site. And in California, it's almost like you can never have enough compost tea because the soils are really depleted and things have been dried out. And that's not saying the nutrients and the minerals aren't still there in large part. They are. Decomposed granite melts into loam. It's unbelievable. And I discovered this past week something that I probably should have figured out a while ago, but I've been tromping through these woods for a while, you know, logging roads are stuff that I always come across, but I'd never been mapping out the watershed and like potential pond sites and then come across these roads, these logging roads that were perpendicular to, that's not the way to say it. They were just angled directly down into the slough, and so that it had turned into a gully and was incised. And so I'm like, they're magnifying the water. They're having the water come down like this. If they had flattened it, the water would distribute throughout the hill nice and evenly, like in a ring around the mountain. And so I was like, why did they do that? And then I was mentioning it to one of our team, and he was like, well, that's to get the logs down, man. And I was like, oh, right. So they're going at an angle to where the water is so that they can run it down the water during the water, during the rainy season, just like in a big torrent. And meanwhile, this is a common practice probably. So this is the hidden X factor in the desertification of the American West. We've been cutting drainage, erosion, desertification earthworks for decades into the mountains. And so these mountains are having magnified runoff of all the water, taking the soil with it, leaving it drier earlier in the season, and then having forest fires because it's so dry. So it was really kind of like a moment this week, like realizing that. I didn't mention it in the video I did because I realized that walking back from it, talking to Josh about it, and it was like, is this like a thing? And I like realized, I was like, this thing, this is an X factor that literally anyone can explain. The water goes faster like this instead of like this. And it's like, we could fix this. This could be something that high school kids could, you know what I mean, could take the second half of their junior years. They could go out, they could learn permaculture, they could learn landscaping, they could learn how to protect against mega fires, mm-hmm. and how to resiliently design landscapes to handle fires. And I mean, I went to a boarding school that we literally chopped wood and gave it to people, elderly people in the community. So we'd go out there, we'd be carrying wood, and it's like that our kids need to do this kind of work. I really don't think that they're too good, or that like there's like there it's too hard or something like that. It's like, no. It's like we need to have our kids out there doing this work so that they grow up knowing that this is the way nature works. This is the way we handle our landscapes. And it becomes common sense so that we don't have these like idiotic arguments, you know, at a legislative level on how to handle something so basic as our mountain ranges. And that is like super, super basic, even though people are like, oh, but it's so complicated, Matt. It's like, no, this is the world we live in. It is not that complicated. It's complex, but it's something that we need to be involved with if we're going to thrive. Otherwise, we're going to get T-boned. We're going to get sideswiped. And it's not going to be pretty. Yeah. So, let me answer the question though. So compost teas. So all I'm doing is taking a MicroPerf bag. I'm putting in like 3 to 4 shovelfuls of compost. Compost that's not from where its stuff is still visible. Like, I mean, maybe there's some like eggshells and stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, cool. You're basically broken down. I'm like, calcium, right? But mostly it's pure compost or pure vermicompost. And it's going in there. It's going into the bag. It's going into a 55-gallon barrel. And I've got a carabiner that I cut through. And so it clips on to the carabiner, the bag. And so that's hanging there on the side. You could even do it in the center. A lot of people like doing it in the center and having the aeration go around it. And so, but that's what I always used to do. And then you have an aeration happening. And there's a lot of people would say you must have the exact same aeration as the barrel. So if it's, you know, 40 liters, you have a 40-liter pump, air pump. That's sort of true. Not totally true. I mean, I know people like traditionally they're making compost teas with sticks in a bucket, or they're using a lower aeration and then pulling it earlier. So it's more gentle bubbles, meaning there's more stillness, meaning that it turns anaerobic quicker, but you just grab it earlier. I mean, it's not like, the crazy thing is this, you run water through your compost passively, you come out with humic acids and they're awesome. So like the awesomeness is only like expanded when you put it into a brew or an aeration operation. It's not like it's bad and now we got to fix it. So the margin for error is just like all in your favor here. And so what I do is I aerate it for 1 to 2 days, depending on how hot it is out. Because if it's too hot, it'll just go really quickly and get stinky really quickly, because it's just the processes are happening so quick. And so a lot of people will add like a ton of molasses and will create a really quickly stinky situation. They'll get that biofilm and foam on top. I don't do that. I've used molasses. But whenever I've used molasses, it's in a 55-gallon barrel, and I'm like using little bits of molasses. It's not like it's a molasses machine. You know, I can't drink it and it's sweet. And so we're talking about a few tablespoons of molasses for an entire barrel. And so that's what I have done. And I don't do that anymore, unless I'm on a site where surrounded by evergreens like I am here, right? So I would use molasses while I'm here to establish areas, but then I would ease off of that and then not use that. And then, so I'd be aerating for 1 to 2 days using molasses contextually. And then when I have money, I might add other things, but usually I didn't. I usually didn't. And instead of adding other things, I would add other composts. So I would get a moldering compost. I would get a vermicompost. And then I would get my like thermophilic hot compost from the chickens. And I would have all those different lives. And then I would throw in like maybe some kefir grains or something like that too. So I would always try to bring that diversity up, but nowadays I would like to add in kelp. You know what I mean? Just adding a little bit of kelp just really trains them to feed on that and release it as a more bioavailable thing as they're eaten by the other members of the food soil web. Because bacteria, you know, they're considered like the black box, so that they lock everything up, they lock the nutrients up, and then it's primarily the protozoas that are actually digesting them and then pooping them out, and that is their manure, and that's actually the thing that the plants are able to take in, which is so crazy because we're all like, well, we need to get some manure here at the farm, and like that's what they need down there too. So So yeah, I then I would take that compost tea, and there's two options here. You can do the thing where you're filtering it, you know, and then you're spraying it on things. And I do that every once in a while. But primarily the plant's roots are in the soil. You know what I mean? It's like they've got the exudates on their bodies, and like you got blight, take care of it. You know what I mean? Use that compost tea with some chitinase in it. And you would develop that by feeding insect frass into your compost pile so that they would create chitinase in the process by breaking down the chitin. You need chitinase. So someone in the consortium would use chitinase, and then it would be present. And then you would be able to spray it on your blight or your disease, and it would break it down, because chitin is the exoskeletons of microarthropods, all of our pests. And then it's also the cell walls of fungi, which is, you know, our blights, our molds, those kinds of things. So that's like that I would do as just dealing with things. But if I had insect frass regularly, like I said, I know people who are adding like 14 ingredients to their compost. Mm-hmm. They've got like everything dialed in. They bought all the little pieces. And I never had all the pieces. I never had all the money. And so I just did things myself. Worm castings made from digested insect frass is the ultimate. So I really would recommend working with that, adding that in if you can. If you can't, know that you can do these things at the lowest, you know, bar none level, and yep, still have huge. I was doing this simple stuff and composting probably every few weeks for 3 months, and my soils went from, you know, bulletproof to as deep as my shoulder. And so you might be like, oh man, that's a lot of brewing and a lot of moving around of liquid. But what I would do is I would do a bucket, 5 gallon bucket, and I would walk, and I would take a cup, and I would go like this with a cup, and I would literally ladle it onto the ground and let it soak in. And people are like, oh, but you wouldn't water it down. You're supposed to do 4-to-1, Matt. This is crazy. I'd put on the sprinkler after and water it in. And so again, I do things, I tend to do things with the understanding of what everyone's doing with their like super perfect techniques. And I'm like, I can't buy that thing, or I don't have time. And I go off the principles. And so I tend to figure things out that work really well just because I apply the scientific principles at work in a more condensed format.
Yeah.
So that's what I would do with the teas. And then nowadays I would be alternating more with like EM. I think I would also be doing more foliar sprays, just because of what I know about kelp and about flowers. So if you're spraying the open flower with like a kelp foliar spray, you're going to increase your yields like ridiculous. And because what happens is they're going into the fruit. So it's going in, the flower is like the open, it's the open sexual organ. And so when you put stuff in that, you are literally affecting the next generation seed, fruit, genetics, and the indigenous microbiology that will be implicit in the plant, because everything has the biology in it. Well, how does it get into us? It's our food, it's in our eyes, it's in our breath, and it's the same thing for the plant. So when we have this built up, focused, potent biology, and the kelp's broad spectrum of minerals and trace minerals and nutrients, when we spray that right into the womb of the next generation of that plant, you give it it's like prenatal vitamins. You give it all the different things so that it can really pick and choose, you know, what will serve it best.
Spraying on foliage on leaves, but you're actually taking this further and going straight into the flowers and the fruits.
Yeah, it was really something else when I learned that you could put biology into the future plant by spraying the flower. But it makes perfect sense. I mean, think about how much care we put in and how much concern we put into our own, you know, biology, sexual organs, fertility, and all those kinds of things. It's like, they're all just as sensitive. So yeah, it's really powerful. And that's why I feel like, you know, I'm here to share a lot of this information, because for a lot of people, they're like, wow, I've never thought about it that way before. And that's why I feel like part of my mission as an educator is to get this to be common knowledge, to be such common sense that I don't need to teach it anymore. Yeah. It's just implicit in the way we raise our kids in school and live.
Yeah, as it should be. No, and to your point of, you know, not getting too tied into the mechanics, the specifics, you know, I did a video on aquaponics not long ago, where, you know, often I feel like people will look up, okay, my system is this many gallons, and that means I need a flow rate of this, and there's going to be this much nitrogen coming off the fish. And it's like, guys, whoa, like, this will work no matter what. Like, I've seen guys that don't even have pumps and will just take a bucket of water from their fish tank whenever they can and dump it in the top and let it trickle down to the plants. And yes, they're not going to operate a commercial aquaponics in a greenhouse installation like that, because those guys are trying to print money as fast as they can to cover their exorbitant costs. But you can get this to work using imperfect, right? It doesn't have to be the mathematically optimal formula we're maximizing here. You can just grow some food and be very, very happy with that. Okay, so we're over 90 minutes now. Any final, we've named a bunch of awesome things and talked about soil building. Are there any practices that we should have included here that we've neglected to mention, or anything else? Open question.
Yeah, probably vermicompost, worm farming. Okay. That's another so simple and easy kind of process. It's more restrictive, right? You can't put the bones, the dairy, the meat, certain spicy peppers and citrus and stuff like that in with the worms, but the results are stunning. And they exponentially grow. And so you can keep creating more and more, you know, worms, and then the worms go out into your garden and then they improve your garden. So that's another exponential lead-in that I didn't cover, but I should have.
Yeah, totally. And do you, what do you do with the leachate?
Yeah, so a lot of people just let that like kind of build up and become anaerobic. My whole thing is I want to keep that aerobic as much as possible. So it's really about keeping it going. It's like I get that leachate out of there as fast as possible. I've actually got a giant bucket of leachate that I showed up and it was like a stagnant bucket. And I'm like, all right, I got to move you. You know what I mean? So it's like, but even in those stagnant situations though, there's nutrients in there, and it's all about flipping it so that those nutrients, you know, it's like that sunlight, right? It's too much sunlight for those plants. Those plants either need to flip some genes or they need to, they probably just need to flip some genes. So yeah, I have issues with some of the leachate because it can stink. And if it stinks, I don't use anything that stinks. And for me, if it stunk, like for instance, this, I don't have any EM right now, but I'm getting some, I'm expecting some from Quatamuck. I bartered some books with them. But as soon as I get that, I'm going to put it in that and then aerate it, and then it will be good again. It'll be the worm ambrosia that it should be.
Absolutely. Interesting that you don't use things that stink. Tell me, why is that your general guidance? Because there's definitely stuff out there that's thought to be good that smells terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in many ways, it's because I was taught by Elaine initially. Elaine, everything is aerobic. So everything smells good. Everything is like, she can lick her fingers after working with her compost. And that was like the the standard, you know what I mean? The idea that everything's like sterile, not sterile, you know what I mean? But like, safe for us. But, and then even with Bokashi and even with EM, it's the absence of the smell. And so for me, when there's a smell, there's like a hole in the system or the armor. And so I'm like, well, if it smells, something is being gassed off, something's leaking. And we want to tie that up. We want to fix that. And so I'm not saying I don't work with things that stink, but I don't like eat that. I don't use that on the plants that I'm about to eat. I have to have it go through a process and then I'm cool with it. Just because of the anaerobes or where all the disease and pathogens are. And that stink is a warning biologically from our body that that's not what you want to eat. Mm-hmm. And just because like it helps in a decomposition cycle or helps boost a certain aspect of the cycle, doesn't mean that I'm going to eat it, you know what I mean? Or eat it that day. Mm-hmm. I would have to have it go through a step or two on that process to get it back. Like that's the stinky worm ambrosia. If I'm fixing it and then it's no longer stinky, then I feel like super confident about it because it's been pushed back into the aerobic side of things. And just to make things even more complicated, Michael Phillips aerates his EM, which I'm still trying to figure out because EM is like a facultative and usually you seal it and let it work on in a closed environment. And then it gets really resourceful actually. But there are a lot of ways to do these things. And I know people that are doing things with stinky things, even applying stinky things and using those things as ways to deal with pests, as ways to shock plants. And they're effective. But on that day that you're going out and spraying anaerobic stuff all over everything, you're not going to go out and like roll in the fields and you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, right.
And I don't mean anaerobic as in facultative because all the EM consortium are edible. And so they're nothing to worry about. I'm talking about like really stinky stuff. Like people talking about taking mushroom conchs, like polypore mushroom conchs, decomposing them in water for 2 months and then taking that stinky black liquid and spraying it on pests and it'll digest them. No doubt, but you might have pathogens and you might have to wash your hands very carefully and you know those kinds of things too. So that's why I stay away from things that stink.
Good answer. Matt, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I think we've covered a lot of awesome ground today. I really enjoyed it and I think we've left some avenues to follow further in the future. I'll definitely be dropping a link. Well, first of all, to thepermaculturestudent.com, where you can pick up Matt's book, The Permaculture Student 2, and for free. And then I'll drop a link to Chris Trump and a bunch of these other things we've mentioned for EM. And there's a ton of great resources out there. So once again, thanks so much for your time. And we'll be talking soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. So what are you doing in Germany?
Yeah, family situation brings us here. But it's good. Like, you always see things through fresh eyes when you're in new places. And I'm walking around and seeing a bunch of things like guerrilla gardening just in the last few years has really taken off. So that people in apartments are actually arguing over who gets access to the, one square meter outside their apartment buildings and stuff like this. It's fantastic. So people are growing lavender and all sorts of things. It is record cold, and so everyone's walking around in jackets, and I'm not packed for that.
Yeah,
but it's super fun. Yeah, they've also got like where there were fields, like in parks, playgrounds, or next to large grassy fields. Those have been replaced, and this is just in the last couple of years since my wife and I were last here. They've just got these areas that are designated pollinator friendly zones where they let things grow and they add some, you know, poppies and things like this to bring in the pollinators. And you'll see that, I guess Germany is where they've been doing the insect biomass collapsing studies. So there seems to be a more and more of like people trying to get out and help bees and in general growing things. It's good to see.
That's amazing. Yeah, it seems like the commons have such potential to be flipped. Like the greens, you know what I mean? The central meeting places in a lot of European cities are these areas that are kind of almost reminiscent of a different time period. But they're still around. It's like we lost, like a lot of Europe lost their forests, you know, at different points and different times. But these greens, this practice of having an open area in the middle of town persisted. And it's really amazing to hear that they're being inoculated with gardens and then pollinator habitat rewilding, essentially.
So my last visit, I was surprised, and I did a couple of videos about this. It was great to see the Schreber Gardens, where people, it's like one farmer has a bunch of land and will just take like 2 or 3 acres and set it aside and parcel it out just by, you know, 10 square meters or so. So you go down from your apartment and you've got to walk. It's not your land. But you go down to where you've just got a small little lot, plot, you can grow stuff there. And people take it seriously, right? They really trick it out and put in little fountains and, you know, the gnomes and little buildings from which they catch water and irrigate things. So they take their garden seriously here. But it's definitely spread now just to the, you know, in the cities across the
wow. Garden. So you're seeing like urban permaculture really be adopted
on a super small scale, but aggressively. Yeah.
That's the first scale. I mean, like it's the novelty, right? It's like, I started a garden this year, you know, and they're just like, it's new. And then they are like, next year, they're like, no, I'm a gardener now. You know what I mean? And it's like that progression. So yeah, we got to start small, especially in the cities. It has to go that viral, like suddenly everyone's carrying that certain thing, you know?
Absolutely.
Or eating that certain way.
Yeah. And I feel like by and large, people tend to, there's just not that divide between like, oh, I don't garden. Like everybody sort of has a couple tomatoes or a couple things outside that they do. And it's not, you know, I feel like Americans tend to be like, all of a sudden, I'm a gardener now, and I'm going to go balls to the wall and all, you know, huge out. But here it's just like, well, I guess I'll go to the place. Everyone
does it. You know? What does that say about Americans that, like, personality-wise, we're like, this is my new identity?
Yeah, I don't know.
And people are like, whoa, I didn't know you were this religion now, or you're this culture? Yes, I am this culture now. It's been a pattern since I've been a kid. Like I was in Iowa, like a wedding when I was like 10, and all the kids like in Iowa, like deep in like corn country, were like hardcore into like Vanilla Ice and like MC Hammer, man. And I was like, really? Yeah. And it's like, it's like, where does that come from? I don't get that. I wonder if it's the erasure of public schooling that happens, that erasure of ability for us to grow our own identities or have like a community culture. I don't know, because I mean, they obviously have standardized schooling, you know, in Europe. So, but it's uniquely, I mean, there's a lot of things that are uniquely American. I think that kind of rah, like all the way in thing is incredibly important. And I think that is American in some ways, but yeah, I wish I understood it a little bit better so that I could like help my students and my fellow Americans like channel some of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I fall victim to it too.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first got into permaculture, I was like, permaculture, you're not permaculture, permaculture. Instead of being like, you are already doing permaculture. Let me explain how you're awesome. Which works much better.
Totally. All right.